Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's been 45 years since the Supreme Court issued its landmark Roe v. Wade ruling. The 7-2 decision gave women control over their bodies with a constitutional right to choose to have an abortion. Well, 45 years later, women's rights are under attack like never before. Mostly Republican legislators have enacted extreme restrictions to limit access. In many states, women and girls have to fly to neighboring states or travel for hours to have the procedure. The Guttmacher Institute, an institution promoting reproductive health rights, tallies different kinds of restrictions by state. Some states require that abortions be performed in a hospital or with multiple doctors present. Many allow doctors to refuse to perform the procedure altogether. Others require counseling or waiting periods. And 23 states have so-called trap laws. They target abortion providers with specific requirements for facilities. Now, these restrictions hit low-income women and women of color particularly hard. It's important to note that even though we constantly hear that abortion is the most divisive issue of our time, according to new research by Pew, 70% of the population actually supports Roe v. Wade. So on today's Your Call, we are joined by women who are fighting these restrictions, and a few of our guests remember what life was like before abortion was legal. Liz Niss was an ICU nurse before Roe v. Wade was decided. Since then, she's worked in politics, serving on Palo Alto City Council, and recently selected to serve as the mayor of Palo Alto. And Liz Niss joins us in studio. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Great to have you. Lisa Lindeleff is a San Francisco-based community activist, volunteer, attorney, and psychotherapist, and she also remembers what life was like before abortion was legal. Hi, Lisa. Thank you for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
And Laji Dua Salazar is a social justice organizer with a focus on education and reproductive health. She serves on the board of Access Women's Health Justice, which connects women to reproductive care services, and she's also an abortion storyteller. And Laji Dua joins us in studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Well, it's great to have all of you. It's amazing when you think about where we are today. And I just want to ask you, Liz and Lisa, because you remember what life was like before abortion was legal. Lisa, 45 years ago this week, we got that ruling. How are you reflecting right now?
Well, I've been doing a lot of remembering back to pre-Roe and how I originally got involved with this issue. And it was back when I was in high school, and girls in my class were disappearing and sometimes coming back and sometimes not coming back. And, of course, nobody talked about what was going on. But they were, at that time, all going to usually, I was in Southern California, usually Mexico, sometimes Scandinavia. It was just one big dark secret. And I'm just going on the anniversary. How did we get back here? How did we backslide so much?
What about you, Liz? How are you reflecting?
Well, I think there are two aspects of this that are really troubling. When I was right out of college, I came to San Francisco. I worked here. I was in ICU. And what we saw the most often after 11 o'clock at night, when the doctors were willing to take on the delicate issue of abortion, we would see the girls, who are usually very young, coming into ICU to recover. They had to have three psychiatrists' indications that they were mentally unstable or suicidal before they could do the abortion. You can imagine you're 15 and you're in a hospital and you wake up and you're in an intensive care unit. Be shocking. Then I went on to Wisconsin, where I worked as a hospital administrator, and where we had an entire floor, the Florence Crittenden floor, of young girls who were in late stages of pregnancy. But when they delivered their child, the child was taken from them because they were unconscious, and they were never seen again. So two stories that talk about ending a pregnancy and then another end of a pregnancy. Both of those were just alarming and horrifying, and I remember them almost as though they had just happened.
Laji Dua, what goes through your mind when you hear these stories?
We often talk about that it's impossible to end abortion. You can end safe and legal abortion, but people who need access to abortion will find ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so the onslaught of restrictions really just make it more difficult for people to access safe abortions. They will still seek the type of pregnancy termination that they need, and often it's dangerous. It puts their lives at risks. And it's scary that in a developed country, we are sliding back to that condition.
Even in California, mm-hmm. where we actually have enacted pro-choice legislation, not anti-choice legislation, it is difficult for a lot of women to access abortion.
Yes. California has a very strong constitutional protection of abortion. However, services are often in metropolitan areas. So for us in the Bay Area, it's easy to forget that California is a really large state with many, many people that don't live in the Bay Area, Los Angeles, San Diego, or Sacramento, which is largely where a lot of the services services are offered. And people inland who need access to even just prenatal services have to travel hours on bus. It's primarily what Access does. We coordinate a lot of the travel that people from Modesto and rural areas have to come out here in order to get services, again, even just prenatal.
Wow. What other restrictions are you seeing in terms of access to birth control, access to other reproductive services here in California?
Here in California, we don't have too many restrictions when it comes to birth control. If you have access to the services, I know I have young nieces in Stockton, and they have limited access to even a Planned Parenthood. I'm not sure what the services are like now, but about a couple of years ago, my nieces were mentioning to me that the Planned Parenthood was open for a limited amount of hours during school time once a week. Mm-hmm. And so all the young women who needed access to it, and Stockton's a pretty large city, would have to figure out how to coordinate to skip classes and get the services that they needed.
Mm-hmm. However, can I just jump in? A few years ago, even here in San Francisco, we were able I can't remember exactly who did. It was NARAL, Pro-Choice America, the California office, that there were incidents of pharmacy refusal situations where a pharmacist would refuse to fill a perfectly legitimate birth control prescription based on personal beliefs. Mm. So even here.
Jumping in, though, just to talk about Planned Parenthood for a minute. My daughters are now grown and so forth. But I remember looking, they both had a drawer in the kitchen where put the mail. And I remember looking one day to put something in it, and there was the letter from Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, thank goodness. Because as a mother, you're not quite sure where this should go. And I remember thinking, oh, thank goodness. They got there. They got what they needed. All is well. Mm. So I've always been just grateful to them.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And for a lot of women who lose jobs, who don't have access to health care, they can go to Planned Parenthood mm-hmm. and get either free services or drastically reduced cost services.
Right. And they do.
Right.
Yeah. I'm an undocumented immigrant and for a long time did not have access to health care. And Planned Parenthood has been my primary health provider for many, many years. Oh. Fortunately, now I have health care through my employer. But for as long as I can remember, Planned Parenthood was my primary health care provider.
Loji Dwa makes a really good point about abortion. If you make abortion illegal, women will go through many, many steps to get an abortion regardless, right? And Lisa, can you talk about that? Because, I mean, you saw the realities of what women go through before abortion was legal. And if you make it illegal, we're going to see exactly what we saw back then.
Absolutely. And I think, in a way, even though Roe is still the law, we are seeing it. Right. We are seeing women who perhaps can't access a clinic, are too far away, starting to self-induce by some very, very unpleasant and dangerous means, drinking bleach, things like that. Mm-hmm. So even though it's still on the books, the circumstances and the restrictions are making it harder and harder for particularly poor women and women of color to access services. And I have any number of friends who have been very, very public in talking about their pre-Roe abortions and the horrific conditions that they encountered, you know, dirty tables and, you know, farmhouses, you know, way out in the country and that sort of thing.
There's another aspect of this, too, though. The amount of available health care. So way in the background, I'm also a public health nurse. And when there were more nurses floating around in the community, which is an odd term to use, but when they were more accessible, I spent a lot of time teaching young women about Planned Parenthood and about going to Planned Parenthood and about trying to prevent getting pregnant. Because many young women simply don't understand exactly how you get pregnant, which sounds astonishing, but absolutely true. Or they think that there are safe ways to be involved intimately without getting pregnant. So it's hard sometimes, I think, for very, especially for teens, to get really good information. Do you discover that as well, Lashua?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I think that's part of the problem with all the laws that are being passed to limit access to abortions, that oftentimes contraceptives are thrown in there. So contraceptives are now being viewed as yet another form of abortion, which is ridiculous. By definition, they don't end abortion. They prevent pregnancy. And it also coincides in many states with limited access to sex education.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You don't have sex education. Yeah. You have limited access to contraceptives, and then you're making abortion illegal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, teaching. I also taught sex ed. It sounds like I've done a little of everything. But I remember teaching kids. We started actually in fifth and sixth grade. And I don't think that happens anymore. Mm-hmm. And we continued through middle school. But there simply isn't, the money is not in the schools to provide the kind of health information that used to be so readily available. And I think that is a very sad tale to tell.
Definitely. I grew up in the Bay Area, so I had sex education in the sixth grade, again, in high school. And then when I was a senior, I was teaching sex education for the incoming freshmen. And I think it was pivotal for me to even just know what was healthy in my body and what choices I wanted to make for myself.
Lajidua Salazar is a social justice organizer. She serves on the board of Access Women's Health Justice, which connects women to reproductive care services in California. She's also an abortion storyteller. Lisa Lendeleff is a San Francisco-based community activist, volunteer, attorney, and psychotherapist. And Liz Niss was an ICU nurse before Roe v. Wade was decided. She's also taught sex ed. She has served on Palo Alto City Council, and recently she was selected to serve as the mayor of Palo Alto. And if you'd like to join us, we are marking the 45th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade ruling by talking about what life was like before Roe and how we got to a point where in so many parts of the country, it almost feels illegal. We've done a lot of shows about the trap laws, for example, where women are forced to fly to other states. In some cases, they have to sleep in their cars because they have to have 3 appointments in a row, and the clinic is hours away from where they live. So if you have any stories to share, you can remain anonymous if you'd like. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Tweet us at yourcallradio. Or you can leave a comment on our website. You know, I almost bang my head against the wall because over the years we've done so many shows about this and the question how we got here. And I feel like as a year goes by, it just gets worse. And a year goes by, and we're seeing more restrictions. But when you look back over 45 years, NPR had a really great 12-minute documentary about Jane. That was the collective in Chicago that provided underground abortions. And so many of those women said, when the Roe decision came down, we felt like that was it. We got it.
Yeah.
Now let's move on and figure out how to improve people's lives and make sure women and girls are healthy. And I've heard a lot of my friends who worked on these issues say we felt like that was it.
Mm-hmm. I think we all did. Yeah.
I never believed that 45 years later I would still be working on this issue and this cause.
I also think I'm an elected woman, so one of the things that I would really push hard is elect more women. Women really do vote differently. We may not always acknowledge that, but women who have gone through this, have been exposed to it. Those are the women, I think, that will help change those laws. So I work hard for women. I'm sure both of you do as well. But it does make a big difference. There are fewer women in politics now than there were, particularly in the 80s and 90s.
Do you say elect more pro-choice women? Because a lot of women are voting for these restrictions.
Right.
And the Trump administration has a lot of women in very key positions who oppose abortion, and I'm sure many other
it's
issues.
It's such
you agree
a good
with.
Point. Yes, you might check first, find out where exactly does that person. In California, we tend to have women who are very sympathetic with what we're discussing, but you're right, in the rest of the country. So keep an eye on who you support or send money to. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Also, hold lawmakers accountable. It's super easy to make promises when you are running for office and then not do. California is different because we actually have ongoing laws that protect our access to abortion, where in many places it's on the defensive at this point because so many abortion restrictions are being passed.
Well, it's actually specifically in the California Constitution, which it is not in the federal Constitution.
And on the same token, we still can't just sit back and assume that everything is going to happen. So students are fighting for the right for their schools to provide the abortion pill. And there's different things that happen, a lot of activism that happens in California that makes it so that we don't sit back and think that this is it, that it's in our Constitution, because Roe v. Wade is in the Constitution, right? So it doesn't, we can't sit back and hope that everything's fine and then look back 45 years later and realize that we're right back where we started. Mm.
Why do you all think that, again, how did we get to this place? The anti-choice conservative evangelical movement is very loud and very organized. But it's important to point out, I always go back to this Pew research that shows 70% of the population supports Roe v. Wade. And another interesting thing that we rarely hear about is when these extreme measures are taken to the voters in places like South Dakota or conservative parts of Colorado or Mississippi, they lose. They go down. They do not pass. They only are enacted when extreme politicians introduce them in their legislatures. So we don't really hear much about that. I recently met a man in Canada who said he comes from a conservative city. I don't remember where exactly. But I said, is abortion this? Do you see this in Canada? These restrictions being passed, people talking about this on a regular basis? He said, not at all. We are shocked that it is like this south of our border in your country. He said, why is it so, quote, divisive in your country? Why are so many restrictions being passed?
I think there's an anger factor. For some reason, those who are anti-choice, who are pro-life, I think are very angry. And somehow that anger spills out and seems to, they feel that it influences people. So I can't say that those of us who are on the flip side are not angry, but apparently maybe we didn't get angry enough. And I think anger drives so much in what happens, you know, out there in the world. And I'm always surprised by that. But if you really want to get a group, you know, riled up, find something that they'll get angry about. And it simply is pervasive.
I also think that and we're seeing this in the Me Too movement and a lot of other things going on right now. I think that at base there is a fundamental streak of misogyny in this country, and it's not just around abortion. I mean, it's around education, it's around child care, it's around all kinds of things, and it's kind of the dirty little secret that nobody wants to openly admit. But I really think that is part of what's going on. And I think misogyny, certainly in men, but even in women.
Mm-hmm. Laji, Joy, what do you think?
I think it's easy to talk about abortion when it comes to legislation and think that your moral standing should have a weigh on somebody else's lives and bodies. It's why it's so important to not just talk about abortion in the abstract, but to tell our stories, because mm-hmm. when you realize that it's real people with real lives whose lives can be drastically changed with access to abortion or lack of access to abortion, it's a different conversation. And I think we need to stop talking about abortion as though it's terminating a life. It's a pregnancy. We're terminating a pregnancy. Mm-hmm. You cannot have more stake in the life of a fetus than you do in the life of a woman or a person who's pregnant.
That's very well said, because I think it depends on how you look at it. And if you've seen the pictures that pro-life often demonstrates outside a clinic, you can see why it's difficult for that young woman to go into that clinic and run the gamut before she can do what it is she wishes to do, not what somebody else has dictated she would do.
And you make a good point, because according to the Guttmacher Institute, 1 in 4 women will have an abortion by 25. We're half the country. That's 25%. That's a huge percentage of the population. Why did you decide to share your story? A lot of women are saying, let's get out and share our stories.
It's important for me to share my story also as an undocumented woman, because often when you talk about undocumented people and pregnancies, you talk about anchor babies and, you know, people coming to this country to have babies and take advantage of social services. And the reality is that undocumented people are people just like anybody else who have plans for a life. And sometimes that means having a child and sometimes that doesn't. For me, it didn't. For me, when I found out I was pregnant, I was also in deportation proceedings, and it's not something that I had the capacity to deal with both of those things, nor I'm not saying that I don't want a family eventually. I just know that I don't want to have a family under that degree of uncertainty, and I decided that the best option for me at the time was to have an abortion.
Mm. What is the status of Dreamers right now with healthcare? That's not something we hear much about.
I guess it depends on whether you have access to public health care. For me, other than the private health care that I have through my employer, I was, as I mentioned, Planned Parenthood has always been my primary health provider. But yeah, being undocumented often means that you don't have access to health care. For me, when I needed an abortion, I was, again, fortunate enough to be in California, to be in the Bay Area, and at the time I was already doing reproductive justice work. Mm-hmm. So I knew what my options were, I knew where to go, and I knew that I was not stuck carrying a pregnancy to term that I had no interest in doing.
Mm-hmm. I think you're probably one in, not
yes.
a million, but
yes.
certainly one in many, many who had such an advantage that you knew exactly what your next step could be mm-hmm. and would be.
Oh, yes. I know that I'm the anomaly. I know that living in the Bay Area definitely positions me in a place where I know that I don't have to deal with even the degree of stigma that so many people have to deal with when they have abortions. Last year, Access did a fundraiser, and we were at a theater in the East Bay. And before the movie, I got to do a pitch, and I got up and I said that I work for a reproductive justice organization, which primarily supports women getting abortion, and I got a standing ovation. Mm-hmm. And I know that is Bay Area specific, because mm-hmm. I cannot imagine that would happen in the South.
Right. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the landmark Roe v. Wade decision. It's been 45 years. The 7-2 decision gave women control over their bodies. And here we are in 2018. Women's rights are under attack like never before. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the new documentary Generation Zapped, which investigates the potential dangers of prolonged exposure to radio frequencies from wireless technology. California's Department of Public Health recently released guidelines on how to reduce radiation exposure when you use your cell phone. There's a lot of new data out about this. It's really important. That's tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we will be speaking with Peter Edelman about his new book, Not a Crime to Be Poor, The Criminalization of Poverty in America. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are marking the 45th anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade ruling. It was a 7-2 decision which gave women control over their bodies with a constitutional right to choose to have an abortion. 45 years later, women's rights are under attack like never before. There are so many restrictions on the books which make getting an abortion incredibly difficult for so many women. Some have to fly out of state. Others have to drive hours. They sleep in their cars. These restrictions hit low-income women and women of color particularly hard. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Liz Niss. She was an ICU nurse before Roe v. Wade. She's also taught sex ed. Since then, she served on Palo Alto City Council and was recently selected to serve as the mayor of Palo Alto. Lisa Lindeleff is a local community activist, volunteer, attorney, and psychotherapist. And Laji Dwa Salazar serves on the board of Access Women's Health Justice, and she's also an abortion storyteller. And let's go to a few calls. Let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. I wanted to tell you a couple of stories and make one little point in reaction to, in support of what the guests were saying. My best friend in high school had an illegal abortion back then, and she was hemorrhaging for about 2 or 3 years afterwards. Just didn't, you know, just was hemorrhaging. And then I had another friend who had a horrible illegal abortion back then. You know, she said it hurt like hell. You know, it was just creepy. It was a real back alley deal. And this was in New York City. Mm. And by contrast, I had an abortion after it was legal. It was clean, it was fast, it was sanitary, and I came out great. But you know, your guest said that this anti-abortion sentiment has to do with a lot of anger. I think it's actually really highly cultivated anger that the conservatives used very cynically as an organizing tool starting like back in the 80s to rile up, you know, all this theocratic kind of thinking, and then garner votes that way, and they mm-hmm. still use it the same way that they use homophobia, mm-hmm. you know, the social issues, so-called, to collect the votes. I mean, it could be, I guess, like Canada, that you know, if you don't believe in if you don't believe abortion is right, you don't have one. If your value is that, you know, every child should be born wanted and loved by the parents, you can follow that. Mm. That's all I have to say.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Judy. Thank you for sharing that story. Let's go next to Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm 78, and so I lived through the dark ages, or what I call the dark ages of not being able to have a legal abortion. And I had friend who had an abortion in Mexico and almost died, and it was horrible times. I mean, we lived in any young woman who was sexually active lived in fear of getting pregnant and you know, having the birth control not work and getting pregnant and then what. And you know, and now, I mean, okay, I live in California where it's, you know, paradise, so to speak, but you know, I hear these stories about all over the country about state legislatures, you know, making abortion more and more difficult, and it's terribly frightening. And I heard something, I guess, a couple of weeks ago on the radio about the anti-abortion groups getting women who used to work in abortion clinics together, who, you know, who regretted working there and telling their stories and about how horrible it is to have an abortion. And I mean, they are so well organized and so scary. And it's just, you know, they say, you know, 70% of women or people in this country are pro Roe versus Wade, but you know, it just takes a small group. A small group elected Trump. And I think, you know, I'm a little old to get out into the streets, but I have a 16-year-old granddaughter who is very political and, you know, rights, you know, for women, et cetera. And it's really going to be up to these youngsters to fight this battle again and again.
Thank you so much for calling. You brought up some points about the anti-choice side. What are your thoughts about the effective ways to take this on? I mean, Planned Parenthood and NARAL are huge organizations. What do you think is most effective, La Jidwa?
I think the anti-abortion groups have been doing what we haven't been doing in many years, which is using mimicking civil rights movements in a way to push for the rights of the fetus, right? And what we haven't been talking about is, what we haven't been doing is actively organizing as well. We, unfortunately, the pro-choice movement has often been reactionary, and that has cost us so many legislation because we react to the things that are already being enacted. And we have to stop being afraid to lose. I think in 2010, hundreds of anti-choice legislation were pushed forth, and maybe a fourth of those passed, but that's still a lot of legislation, whereas the pro-choice movement would bring up one or two. And then if we lose, we have nothing. We lose all our ground. So we have to take risks, and we have to not assume that any state is safe, right? That, I mean, even just in California, again, we have a strong constitutional protection for abortion. But if on the federal level they're defunding Planned Parenthood, that impacts our access to services as well. Mm-hmm. So we can't sit and assume that we're in some sort of abortion utopia here in California, and that the changes that are happening at the national level won't begin to impact and trickle down on us as well.
Mm-hmm. So I would add one other thing, because one of the callers who just mentioned the kind of anger which is, you know, a planned anger, the kind of plants that you put out there, the kind of things that you say, searching for people who once worked in an abortion clinic and having them maintain that it's the worst thing in their life, is so calculated and manipulated. And I think, you know, one of the things I'd love to have you just talk about briefly is what NARAL does that we're not all aware of, which is lots of influencing of our elected officials through, I think, rational kinds of decisions. Why don't you talk a little? Because NARAL is so interesting that way.
Yeah.
NARAL is political.
Yes. You know? Yeah. And the reason I can talk about this, I served on the board of NARAL Pro-Choice America for 12 years. NARAL, one of the major distinctions that has to be made is that NARAL is not a provider, unlike Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood certainly plays in the legislative arena, but is known primarily as a provider. NARAL is the leading advocacy organization for, as you say, influencing legislation, getting pro-choice representatives and senators elected, to some extent influencing policy. It's based in Washington, D.C., but there are chapters and or affiliates in many states, including here in California, and actually based here in San Francisco. So it's a very different kind of work, and it's absolutely critical, but that's not to slight the importance of Planned Parenthood and what it does, because as services become less and less available, Planned Parenthood's availability is going to become more and more important, and as it's threatened with defunding. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that mm-hmm. helps. But
no, yeah. I think it's really important to know there is a group out there that yeah. does do a great deal of lobbying, very specific lobbying. They raise money to lobby, and that is their, I see that as their primary goal.
Yes, absolutely.
Is influencing.
That is Liz Nish. She was an ICU nurse before Roe v. Wade was decided. She's now mayor of Palo Alto. Lisa Lindeleff is a San Francisco-based community activist, psychotherapist, and attorney. And Laji Dua Salazar serves on the board of Access Women's Health Justice. She's also an abortion storyteller. And now I would like to welcome Loretta Ross to the show. Loretta is a visiting associate professor at Hampshire College in Women's Studies, where she's teaching a class called White Supremacy in the Age of Trump. She was a co-founder of the sister song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective. Loretta is one of the creators of the term reproductive justice, coined by African-American women in 1994, following the International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo. And one of her latest books is Radical Reproductive Justice, Foundations, Theory, Practices, and Critique. Hi, Loretta. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on your show.
Well, it's great to have you back, Loretta. We've had you on so many times, and I was just saying that I always hit my head against the wall because I always ask, how did we get here? You know, Loretta, you've done so much amazing work around reproductive justice, and in this 45th anniversary, how are you reflecting?
Well, right now, we have to tie the restrictions on abortion to the fact that we're dealing with a bunch of white guys that think they're demographically doomed, and they see their only solution is to coerce or compel white women into having more babies. And I believe that all these restrictions on abortion, birth control, and sex education are not because they want more babies of color. I mean, is there any evidence to that? But because they want more white babies, because in about 30 years, they will be a demographic minority. And they either have to deconstruct democracy to maintain control or compel more white women to have babies. And so if you disconnect the attacks on abortion from the broader struggle against white supremacy, you're only telling half the story.
Mm. Well, and Loretta, like we've said with you many times on the show, there's so many restrictions now across the country, and they hit low-income women and women of color particularly hard. I mean, in some cases, they have to fly out of state, which is very expensive, or they have to travel for hours to have three appointments in a row, and they have to sleep in their cars. I mean, the list goes on.
Well, they cultivate a culture of cruelty. They really have no shame in terms of the hardships that they're willing to inflict on others in order to protect their power. I mean, look what they're doing to the Haitians and the Salvadorians and with the DACA people. I mean, they have no shame. And so, yes, they're going to make it much harder for women who have economic challenges to get abortions or to get even basic health care. You know, they're trying to, of course, deconstruct the Affordable Care Act. These are not people that we can measure by normal moral compasses, because I think their needle has been missing for a while.
Loretta, to that point, we have an email from Ellen who says, women's rights organizations and Democratic politicians have been slow to unite and support each other across lines of race and class. The Hyde Amendment, for example, wasn't even challenged in Congress for decades. It is happening now, thanks to some of your panelists. But what about that?
Well, first of all, let's talk about the frame that wasn't challenged. When Republicans started saying after the Civil Rights Movement that government was the enemy because it was forcing integration, we should have challenged that frame, because it was a short step from them saying government should not be funding abortions, government should not be paying for college or health care or a whole lot of other things that this extremist libertarian framework pushed by people that Nancy McLean talks about in her book became not only the public discourse, but Democrats bought into that analysis too. So it's not just about why they didn't resist Hyde, but why did they not resist the entire framework of government deconstruction? Mm-hmm. Because that's what we're mm-hmm. looking at now.
Mm-hmm. Loretta, we'd love to have you back on to talk about your book, but final question. How do you think, I mean, what's most effective in fighting back against these restrictions?
To have a vision for what we're fighting for. I believe that the most effective thing we need to do is build a U.S.-based human rights movement that holds our country accountable for its violations here and around the world. I think it's not enough just to resist fascism and white supremacy. We do have to have a plan for if we win. And I think that's where human rights comes in. Mm.
Well, Loretta, we'd love to have you back to talk about your new books. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your work.
Thanks for having me on your show. Bye-bye.
Loretta Ross is co-founder of the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective. She was one of the creators of the term reproductive justice back in 1994, and her new book is Radical Reproductive Justice. And today we are talking about the Roe v. Wade decision. It came down 45 years ago this week. Women's rights today are under attack like never before. And we're talking about it with Liz Niss, who was an ICU nurse before Roe. She's now the mayor of Palo Alto. Lisa Lendeleff is an activist, volunteer, psychotherapist, and attorney in San Francisco. And Lajidwa Salazar is on the board of Access Women's Health Justice. They connect women to reproductive care services in California, and she's also an abortion storyteller. And let's go next to Katie F. in Oakland. Hi, Katie F. Thanks for holding.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this and for acknowledging. And Ms. Ross just hit the nail on the head. My friend Ellen Deachy, who used to work for State Senator Milton Marks, had a saying which was, if men could get pregnant, abortion would be a sacrament.
Yes.
And it's quite true. And for me, it has really affected my life. When I was at San Francisco State, I had to find a doctor in San Francisco who led me to a doctor in Berkeley who led me to a extremely good abortionist in Mexico. And when I came back that fall, another woman who had gone also to Tijuana had died. And so that motivated me to become a radical feminist, which led me to work for the Making Abortion Legal campaign. And I was in our office on South Van Ness when word came that the Supreme Court had granted us humanity. And after that, I worked for, devoted my life for 13 years to West Coast Women's Press Plexus to highlight all the struggles that women have to go through. Because power is at the basis of all of this, as Ms. Ross said. And we had on the front page, I think her name was
Rosie
Perez. I can't remember her last name,
yeah.
But she was the first woman to die after the Hyde Amendment was passed.
Mm. So sorry to hear about that other woman. And luckily, KDF, you found a safe provider. Thank you for calling in. We have another email from a listener who says, my mom's dad passed away unexpectedly when she was 3 years old. Several years later, in 1943, my grandmother, her mother, became pregnant with a man she was dating. She already had three children and was very poor, wasn't able to afford another child, and also didn't want the stigma of having a child out of wedlock back then. She found a back alley abortion and had one and hemorrhaged to death. Women will always seek abortions. This is a women's health crisis and healthcare issue, but also a women's rights issue. And I cannot believe we're still debating this. Well, thank you for writing in. And most women cannot believe we're still debating this. A lot of men can't believe we're still debating this. We have about 5 minutes left. We talked a little bit about what's most effective, but what do you think needs to change? I mean, these anti-choice laws are still being introduced across the country, still being passed. What do you think, Lajidwa? What needs to change?
I think Ms. Loretta Ross definitely hit the nail on the head where we have to stop talking about abortion as though it's a privilege, but it's a human rights issue. Again, legislating women's body is not going to stop abortion. A lot of the callers mentioned that they went to Mexico to access abortion. Abortion is largely illegal in Mexico, and yet it's still happening. Mm-hmm. So making it illegal does not stop it from happening. It just puts the lives of people who are seeking abortion at risk. And we need to start talking about how it's threatening lives. And again, you're one of the callers that emailed mentioned that she or that her mother already had children when she sought abortion.
Right.
I think that we stuck on the single narrative where it's, you know, young women who are too irresponsible to have babies, but by and large, a lot of women who already have families are seeking abortion, and we have to stop assuming that we know better than the people who are seeking abortions. Mm. 95% of people who have abortions don't regret their abortions. We actually know what we're doing with our bodies. We actually might know a little bit something more about our lives than the legislatures do. I mean,
No, you're right. According to Guttmacher, 59% of women obtaining abortions are mothers. 59%.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with not caring about life. But if you're in a situation where you're already low income and you have three children, is it more irresponsible to have said child and make your life and the life of your other children more difficult? Or is the responsible choice actually to have an abortion and to know that you can parent, to know that you have the right to decide if and when you choose to parent, and you should have to, you should be able to do that with dignity, and that if that means having an abortion, if that means having access to public services to take care of said children, yeah. we cannot talk about life and detach it from the fact that we also live in a country that has limited access to healthcare, mm-hmm. limited access to resources. Once people do decide to carry a pregnancy through, that people go into debt because of healthcare. So what happens to the people who do see pregnancy through and don't have healthcare and then mm-hmm. are attempting to give birth? We have to talk about abortion as though it's not an antithesis to having a family. It is family planning. Abortion is family planning.
You raise a really good point. The hypocrisy of making abortion less available, but not having the supplemental services, mm-hmm. health care, child care, the hypocrisy is just staggering to me. And it's not just about choosing whether or not to have a family, that or when to have a family. That has tremendous implications going on down through the lives of the mother and the children. If you can't plan your family, if you can't plan the size, that affects whether you can continue your education, which in turn continues can affect your ability to earn more money, to be in a stable job. I mean, it is not a single issue. It is really a societal issue.
That's I think you've expressed it so well. I think programs like this, though, help enormously. Mm. If it raises somebody's level of awareness so that they're willing to speak out more, willing to support somebody who believes in what we've talked about this morning. One last thing I would say is I think we need to look to some other countries. Why does Canada not have the problem? Why does Denmark not have the problem? What is there in our country that's allowed us to go backwards so fast when other countries have not had that happen? I hadn't thought about that until, especially with Canada. Mm. Come on, they're right over the border. This can't be that difficult. So I think we need to look at some new ways. But I love your comments about, you know, planning is not illegal.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we also need to stop talking about abortion as though it's a dirty word.
Yeah.
The more we talk about it, I mean, one of the things that anti-abortion activists do very well is that they indoctrinate their children, right? Why are we not having conversations about abortion over dinner? Why is it is awkward conversation that we avoid? I talk about abortion all the time, and much to my mother's dismay.
What about the language? Because we're getting a few emails from listeners who say, please do not use their chosen term pro-life to define the opposition.
Right.
They cleverly chose a term that on the surface, who would object to that? After mm-hmm. all, who isn't pro-life?
But isn't that a great... That again, is if you're thinking of a message, which is what we do in politics all the time, isn't that great messaging?
Yep.
Pro-life means that we're actually anti-life. It's amazing. It's just amazing. You have to admire that they really thought about how to put it out in the public, and I think we need to do the same.
It also supports the legislation that they pass on with the personhood amendments that they're passing in different states, right? If they are pro-life, they are defending the life of said fetus. If you define personhood at
X weeks,
then all of a sudden you're not having an abortion, you are killing a fetus, right? You're kidding. It's no longer a fetus. It's a person. It's a full-on person, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are going to continue this discussion next Tuesday with Jody Jacobson, who's the editor-in-chief of Rewire, and talk about how the media cover these issues, because that's also very important.
Absolutely. How
do they choose the terms pro-life, pro-choice, anti-choice? And to say that it's the most divisive issue of our time, but not letting people know that research shows 70% of the population actually supports Roe v. Wade. And when these extreme changes go to the voters, propositions go to the voters, they don't pass. It's just when legislators introduce them in state houses across the country.
So elect pro-choice representatives and senators. That's one other thing that we have to do.
And have more programs like this that really expose what's going on. And it's great to hear someone at your age who's so involved in this and so articulate about it.
Thank you. I think have the conversations whenever possible. It's also one of the things where we have to talk about reproductive health as normal, and we should not have to shy away from these conversations.
Lajidwa Salazar serves on the board of Access Women's Health Justice, which connects women to reproductive care services in California. She's also an abortion storyteller. Lisa Lendelef is a local activist, volunteer, attorney, and psychotherapist. And Liz Niss was an ICU nurse before Roe v. Wade was decided. She is now the mayor of Palo Alto. Lajidwa, Lisa, and Liz, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for asking us.
Thank you so much. Coming up on Thursday at 7 p.m., I'll be moderating a free panel called Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. It's at the First Unitarian, 1187 Franklin Street. It's at 7 to 9. You can find more information online. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the new documentary Generation Zapped, which investigates the potential dangers of prolonged exposure to radio frequencies from wireless technology. California's Department of Public Health recently released guidelines on how to reduce radiation exposure when you use a cell phone. So I hope you can join us for that. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio. Email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Lauren Schechter is our social media producer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. It's Your Call.